Let's say you're working two jobs, total of, say, 60 hours a week at minimum wage. You know what your salary would be? Less than $23,000 a year. If you have a couple kids, you're living in poverty. I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we look at minimum wage. With recent strikes at fast food restaurants around the city and the country, we'll take a moment to look at the complicated pros and cons of raising the minimum wage. How would it hurt business? How much could it help the lives of those who work for it? Then later in the hour, we'll look back on the life of E. Gray Diamond, a founder of the UMKC School of Medicine. Some of his former colleagues will help us remember a life well lived. That's coming up on Central Standard, after the news. If you were trying to get a Whopper or a Big Mac on certain days in many American cities last summer, including Kansas City, you might have come up short. Fast food workers were striking, a symbolic gesture to draw attention to a widening conversation. How much pay is too little pay? Is $7.25 an hour just not enough? Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we explore the minimum wage. Why do we have one? To whom does it matter? And should it be more? Joining us to talk about that are Dr. Peter Eaton, Associate Professor of Economics at UMKC. Welcome to you, Dr. Eaton.
Good morning.
And Patrick Ishmael. He's Policy Analyst for the Show Me Institute. Patrick, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Throughout the segment of our program, we also want to hear from you. If you are working for or at or near minimum wage, we want to know what that's like, what your thoughts are on calls for increasing it. You can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also leave comments at KCUR's Facebook page. We're also on Twitter at KCURCST. Later on the program today, we'll take a look back at the life of UMKC Medical School founder E. Gray Diamond. But first, the minimum wage. Dr. Eaton, why don't we start with you? Why do we even have a minimum wage?
Well, back in the 1930s, there was a movement to protect labor from the large corporation, to develop a countervailing power to the power of the large corporations.
Mm-hmm. And what was the power being used for? I mean, why did they need to be protected?
Well, if you listen to some of the early music, St. Peter, don't you call me because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Right.
There was simply a situation in which labor was not able to earn a living wage in the 30s after the Great Depression.
And so we're talking about the 1930s, about the time that we start talking about a minimum wage. How has it changed over the years, the purpose as well as the level of support it provided?
Well, if you were to take the minimum wage back in the late 30s, and there's been a sort of an up and down relationship, currently the minimum wage is relatively low relative to its historical average, relative to what it was when I was working at a minimum wage job for $1.25 in the 60s.
You're saying the $1.25 in the 60s would have gone further than the $7.25 in today's economy.
That's correct.
Patrick Ishmael of the Show Me Institute, what are the minimum wage jobs out there? What employees are making minimum wage today?
Well, there's a wide variety. I think the more common example is fast food employees, but there are lots of entry-level jobs that pay minimum wage, grocery stores and gas stations and the like. As a percentage of the hourly workforce, it's actually relatively low. It's a little bit less than 5%. And if you look at minimum wage as a composition of the hourly workforce over the last 30 or 40 years, it's gone all the way up towards 10, 11, 12% of the hourly workforce. Today, it's actually at a generally lower average than it's been in the last few decades.
And that's those who are working right at minimum wage.
At or below, correct.
At or below. And then how are people working below minimum wage? How does that happen?
Well, there are. It is possible to be, for example, a restaurant worker that survives on tips. they are paid less than an hourly minimum wage.
So who is working for minimum wage? We've talked about what jobs they're doing, but who are these folks? Are they disproportionately racial minorities? Are they more women than men? Who are those who are working for minimum wage today?
Well, I just read an article in the New York Times that looked at that composition. In fact, the majority are white, although there is a more than proportional representation among minorities in the minimum wage jobs.
And about half are between the ages of 16 and 24, a little bit over 50%. The remaining are over. They're 25 and over. About two-thirds are part-time workers, about a third are full-time. And predominantly, when you look at the family incomes of these minimum wage workers, over half are not in poverty. In fact, only about a quarter of those who are working at minimum wage have a family income that is below 150% of the poverty level. That's why when we talk about raising the minimum wage, you know, we talk about it as a way of combating poverty. But the question is it really targeted enough? Is it efficient and effective enough? I have my own concerns.
Sure. Do we have any evidence about undocumented laborers and what they're paid? Because they're working in sort of a shadow economy, are they getting paid even less? Is that an assumption we should make, Patrick?
Well, there's
Peter. I'm sorry. I looked at Peter and said Patrick. Patrick?
That's okay. There certainly is a cash economy, and I think that you will definitely probably have folks who are working underneath the minimum wage. There are going to be folks who are going to be above that as well. But if you're undocumented, obviously you're going to be off the books, and so it's a little bit harder to tell what those undocumented workers are being paid.
Which means there's families in America living on even less.
Oh, certainly. But more than represented among the fast food industry. If you look at there was a recent report published by a professor at University of California, Berkeley, specifically addressing the use of public assistance by low-wage workers. And this report found that 52% of workers in the fast food industry make use of they only looked at four federal programs, the Earned Income Tax Credit, food stamps, Medicaid and CHIPS, and TANF. And it found that almost $7 billion of welfare assistance is paid to these workers. They could not survive without those dollars. And in fact, what this constitutes is a benefit to McDonald's and other fast food restaurants. They actually use those resources and prescribe to their employees that they make use of them.
You're essentially saying that through federal welfare programs, the salaries of McDonald's employees are being supplemented.
Supplemented to the tune of about $4 an hour.
What do you think of that, Patrick? I mean, is it true that there's an immense cost to the taxpayer from the minimum wage not being higher?
You know, I don't think there's necessarily that kind of a relationship. And I think when we talk about the programs that folks who are making a minimum wage are taking advantage of, I mean, those programs are in place not for any company, but they're in place because we found as a society that we wanted to provide X entitlement for someone in a certain situation. It's not – I think it's incorrect to try to blame a job creator and a job provider for the social entitlements that we as a country have guaranteed to folks.
We're talking about – go ahead, Dr. Eaton.
Well, I think this is really more a moral question than an economic one, although an economic argument can be made. Someone who is working full-time should be able to provide for their family with food, shelter, medical, health provision, education, and clothing. And the fact is that 25% of workers, these are not folks who are sitting around just receiving welfare. These are 25% of our workforce has family engaged in at least one of those four federal programs, and that's an understatement of the true incidence.
So I do want to get into what you've called a moral argument as well, but I think I want to dig a little further into sort of the economics of it and get to how we got here. The minimum wage today, the federal minimum wage, is $7.25 an hour. And as we said at the top of the hour, if a person's working 60 hours a week at $7.25 an hour, it works out to an annual salary before taxes of something like $23,000. How did we get to that being the minimum wage in this country? What criteria were used to establish that as the number?
Actually, there really is not a criterion that's been used to establish that. It's not based on what is necessary to get by. It's not based on anything other than the power of of different parties, political parties, as time goes by. And as time has gone by recently, the real value of the minimum wage has gone down.
Mm-hmm. And when we look back over time, how the original minimum wage was about 25 cents an hour. In today's dollars, that works out to about $4 an hour. And the professor is exactly right. It swung all over the place when you look at inflation and what's being paid at any particular time. If you look at it in today's dollars, it's ranged between $4 and $10 an hour. And I think it's just one more example of how it's probably not in our best interest, not in the best interest of the labor market in particular, to allow the government to basically say what the value of our labor is, because economically speaking, it can actually push people out of the workforce if you set that rate too high.
I guess I'm curious, what do we think an actual living wage would be? I don't know if economists all agree on this, but what would represent a so-called living wage, a wage that would allow people to actually support themselves without further benefits?
Well, I think there have been a number of attempts to come up with that number. Probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $16 an hour would be my guess. But even that will not get someone through a medical emergency. Healthcare costs dominate everything in this country.
All right. Well, I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. What do you think about the minimum wage? We especially want to hear from people for whom this is not just an academic question, but real life. If you are working or have worked for minimum wage or maybe just a little above, call us and tell us how you're making that work or what you think about calls to increase the minimum wage. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet. We're at KCURCST. You can also make comments on Facebook or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We've got some comments on Facebook. Danny wrote, "No one on their own could earn a living with that. It's just simple math." And Kathleen suggests on Facebook that minimum wage should be at least $10 an hour. "I have two adult children, both of whom are college educated, who are baristas at Starbucks. They're struggling to make student loan payments. They work hard, long hours, and they're getting further and further behind." Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. Our two guests today are Dr. Peter Eaton from the Economics Department here at UMKC and Patrick Ishmael, policy analyst for the Show Me Institute. They come from different places on this issue, as I think is perhaps becoming clear and may become more clear. Patrick Ishmael, we're not talking about very much money if you're working at $7.25 an hour. What's the problem with raising the minimum wage, which many are calling on the government to do?
Well, I think there are a few reasons that you wouldn't necessarily want to do that. If you want to make sure that you're targeting poverty, making sure that people are going to be able to make more money and have gainful employment, if you raise that minimum wage, what you end up doing is pricing out some people in the market. Folks whose labor would otherwise, would go for $7 an hour wouldn't be able to necessarily get a job at $10 an hour. And so employers are going to be a lot more selective about who they're going to hire. If you raise that rate, chances are pretty good that the cost of your goods and services are also going to rise. And when you look at folks in poverty, it's not a minimum wage problem. It's a jobs problem. Only 9% of those in poverty work full-time at a minimum wage job. The rest are either part-time or are not working. And so I think if we're implementing policies that limit job creation and job growth, that works to our disadvantage, and particularly to the disadvantage of those in poverty. I think the compassionate response is making sure that they can get a job, not necessarily trying to guarantee a higher wage that the market wouldn't deliver.
Obviously, you see it differently, Peter Eaton.
I do, and I think we can look historically. Perhaps it doesn't have to be a minimum wage. There have been in history situations in which labor has been disadvantaged, and they have responded by, for example, increased unionization in the 1930s, the United Auto Workers being a primary example. The same sort of arguments were being made back then about production workers not being productive enough to earn a living wage, when in fact they were. And now I think you can look at how income is distributed. Look at the earnings of the CEOs of McDonald's, et cetera, and you will find that they're earning $13 million a year, for example. That's the CEO of McDonald's. There is no way that you can justify that being a payment for the production that that individual is responsible
sure.
for.
Sure. I mean, well, let me ask that, Patrick. I mean, what of that? There's a difference between being a company becoming unprofitable and simply being a little less profitable. I mean, isn't it true that the money that is not going to workers in slightly higher wages is going instead to shareholders or to the CEO's salary? Couldn't that balance be shifted and make life better for a lot of people?
I mean, I think the question is who should be shifting it, and for what reason can we justify from a moral or ethical perspective that sort of a shift? When we talk about McDonald's CEO making $13 million, I mean, we have sports players that make lots and lots of money, certainly in the same ballpark, pun not intended. but we never look at that. Well, I guess some folks look at it, and I used to look at it this way, where it's, well, how could they possibly make that kind of money? Well, it's because they are that productive. It's the marketplace that's actually saying, this is what your labor is worth. That's what McDonald's CEO's labor is worth in that particular market. And I don't think it's unusual to suggest that there are some folks who have, through hard work and have gone to a place where their labor is demanded at that level.
But you don't think it's a moral issue that companies should be paying their employees closer to a living wage?
I think it's fair for consumers to look at a company's business practices and decide for themselves whether that's a company they want to do business with based off of how they treat their employees. And I think that if once we get beyond that, I think the market is a very good cop on this point, I think.
Peter Eaton?
A couple of things. Number one, you mentioned baseball players or professional sports. They are represented by very strong unions, and they have a countervailing power to the owners of their franchises.
They also have a monopoly in those leagues as well. MLB, NFL, those are also monopolies.
That's exactly right.
That's right.
And so that's why that's where the market fails, because you've seen many cases where the leagues can't actually come to an agreement. That's really beside the point.
Right. We're way off of minimum wage, but it does get to the sort of the philosophical issues about the regulation of what people are paying.
That's right. And I think we can the argument about minimum wage workers losing jobs because of an increase in minimum, I think there are a couple of sides to that story, and this is where the economic argument becomes confused. Because our economy suffers from a lack of aggregate demand. We don't have sufficient income being generated to purchase goods and services. An increase in minimum wages will, in fact, increase aggregate demand and result in increased jobs. So I don't think you can conclude, only by looking at it in a very static fashion do you come to the conclusion that the simple demand and supply framework works here. It's a much more dynamic situation than that.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. We're especially looking to hear from people who have worked or who are working at minimum wage jobs. Let's take a call from Kent in Columbia. Kent, good morning. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. Hello.
Good morning. Welcome.
Hey, I do a lot of work up in the Bakken oil field up there in North Dakota, and Brian Williams did a piece for MSNBC on it, but if you Google it, you'll see that Kentucky Fried, Wendy's, and McDonald's in Williston, North Dakota, their starting wage is $17.50 an hour. They're actually giving employees health care, and they're giving them a $300 sign-on bonus, and they give some of them a fuel allowance. Hmm. And it's simply because the wages up there, the prevailing wage to drive a truck or work an oil field, is really high. It's above the national norm, so they cannot get anyone to come in and do the minimum wage job. So my point would be McDonald's, Wendy's, and Kentucky Fried, even though you pay the same for a Big Mac up in Williston, North Dakota, that I do in Overland Park, Kansas, they're still turning a profit. These big corporations are still turning a profit off their Big Mac, and they're paying people $17.50 an hour as a starting wage. And I'd also like to say, your two speakers there, I think the one guy there is there on behalf of humanity, and I think the other guy there, I'm wondering who you represent.
Okay. You know? Well, we'll ask.
Okay,
I appreciate it, Kent. Thanks for the call. Well, and so Kent's making a point that the market will change what the effective wage needs to be in a given place. Is the problem that the market just doesn't justify a higher wage than $7.25 in places other than the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota?
Well, I think that's a good short answer. I mean, when you look at those oil fields right now, I mean, they have a labor shortage. And when you have a labor shortage, the value of that labor rises. That's why they're getting paid what they're getting paid. This came up. The Show Me Institute is based out of St. Louis. I had a similar conversation about minimum wage there. And the professor I was talking to on the radio then was telling me that if they did that in St. Louis City, and he was in favor of raising the minimum wage, if you brought it up to $17 or $18 an hour, basically everyone would be unemployed. And the problem isn't, well, you know, we're not paying folks enough. It's the fact is that the market doesn't demand the labor at the price in St. Louis the same way that it does in South Dakota.
Well, Peter.
And if you listen to that statement, what he basically said is we've got too much labor, right, to keep the wage at a higher level. And that's an issue. That is definitely an issue. The reason we have too much labor is because of a lack of aggregate demand, because we have redistributed income in this country so much that there is that the workers cannot afford to buy the goods and services that they produce. Mm. In fact, if you look at fast food workers, they can't afford to buy their own products. And that just doesn't make sense from an economy that is or has historically been the leader of the world and is quickly losing that position.
Don't forget, you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We had a call from Laura. She's not on the line anymore, but she says, very few positions at minimum wage even offer full-time positions, and you have to have completely open availability. It's tough to work for two different jobs, one of the additional challenges that minimum wage workers face is not even getting full-time hours in.
That's exactly right. There are basically three reasons that the fast food industry workers are need to make use of federal assistance so much. Low average wages, their average or the median wage, I believe, is $8.70 an hour, something like that. Low median hours worked is 30 hours a week, and only 13% receive health benefits. So without those things, you can't get by in today's society.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking about minimum wage and recent efforts and conversation about increasing it. Peter Easton of the UMKC Economics Department, Patrick Ishmael of the Show Me Institute are with us, and we hope you will be too at 816-235-2888. Elsa in Liberty joins us. Elsa, good morning.
Good morning. Obviously, I come from a different country, and it is possible that people that work at minimum wage jobs, it's not just the fast food industry, it's the hotels, the maids, it's everywhere, and that's the only area where jobs are going, supposed to be, supposedly right now. So where are we going with this, with the wages going down, down, down?
And Elsa, are you someone who has had to work in that situation?
No, sir, I have not, but I come from Germany. I lived in Germany for years. I grew up there. And all the McDonald people, everybody has health care. That's just a given, and has sick days and has paid vacation. And it makes for a better worker mentally, physically, in every way. And people are happier, too.
Elsa, I really appreciate your call. Thanks for calling. And, well, let me ask you this, Patrick Ishmael. I mean, do business groups and others who tend to oppose increasing the minimum wage, think that those concerns, the poverty issues, can be better addressed through some of the ideas that Elsa is suggesting. Could we provide better health care coverage? Could we provide more sick leave for low-wage workers?
Well, you know, I can't speak for them. But what I will say, though, is that, you know, it's a lot of small businesses that pay minimum wage. And what you see when companies get into the business of trying to push entitlements, oftentimes it's to disadvantage their competition. So, for instance, Walmart was all in favor of having the Affordable Care Act passed because, by and large, they self-insure. Now, on the other hand, Target doesn't really do that with all their employees. And so if they can raise the cost of what Target's doing, Walmart is better off. Now, and that's just a long way of saying just because a single company or corporation would advocate for a certain policy prescription from the government, say, for instance, a higher minimum wage, Walmart already pays, generally speaking, above the minimum wage. But you know who would be hurt by a higher minimum wage? A lot of smaller businesses.
That pay a minimum
that
wage.
That pay a minimum wage.
But we have, as the earlier caller said, we have examples of fast food franchises locating in areas of economic growth with a small labor force, which are able to go. They don't abandon those areas. They continue to work there. They continue to make a profit there. And how is that possible if the arguments that you will hear against the minimum wage are correct?
I mean, there are all sorts of factors. Lower property costs, lower income taxes, higher volume of consumers. I mean, there are lots of ways that you can make it work. It just won't work in every environment.
But everything you said has to do with the public sector. And in fact, that's what's going on here. The public sector is subsidizing fast food. And it's not just fast food workers. It's generalized. Mm-hmm. 25%, as I said, 25% of the labor force has some involvement in one of those four federal government welfare program.
We're talking about the minimum wage. We have a full board of phone calls. So let's talk to Bill in Merriam. Bill, welcome to the program.
Yes, I did have a question, but the producer wanted me to tell a little story. He asked me if I had been on minimum wage, and it kind of shocked me. But yes, I had, and I could barely get along. I was always falling back in rent or utilities, and I get tired of the argument. I keep hearing the reason I called. I just turned on the radio, and the gentleman commented that if the business in St. Louis, if they paid the high wages, they couldn't afford to be in business. Well, that is just baloney. They couldn't afford not to be in business. If they paid good wages, it would come back to them. Economically, it would come back to them if they paid good wages. Henry Ford knew that. It's just ridiculous to think that if a company pays worthwhile wages, that he's going to go out of business.
Bill,
doesn't work that way.
I really appreciate you calling, Bill. Thank you so much.
All right.
Let's take a call from Stan in Kansas City, Missouri. Stan, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. My question is for the fellow from the Show Me Institute or whatever it is. We talk about not raising minimum wage, but if we compare minimum wage to 1963 to today, the effective, adjusted for inflation, the effective minimum wage is going down. So when I hear people talk about not wanting to raise minimum wage, they are implicitly suggesting that it's okay to lower the effective buying power of minimum wage, because that's what inflation has done. So it's no small wonder that the previous caller or others are saying you can't make it on minimum wage, because minimum wage is tracking downward in terms of its buying power when adjusted for inflation.
Stan, thanks.
At the same time, others, the opposite end of the economic spectrum, is tracking upward. So are they in favor of the continued decline of the effective buying rate of minimum wage?
Fair question, Stan. I appreciate it. Let's ask, why shouldn't minimum wage be raised at the very least to keep up with the cost of inflation.
Well, in the 1960s, the effective buying power of minimum wage was at its height. If you went from the very beginning of the minimum wage, which Caller didn't do, 1938, the value of the minimum wage in today's dollars was $4.07. On average, over the last 70 years, the average minimum wage in terms of buying power is $6.60. It's below what the current minimum wage is. And so I'm happy to talk about the history of the minimum wage and what its buying power has been. But if we look at the complete history, not a history that starts in 1960, it's a much lower rate than folks think.
But Patrick, I mean, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but,
sure.
but 60 hours a week at the current minimum wage yields a salary of like $23,000. That's mm-hmm. obviously not enough to live on if you have a couple of kids. I mean, isn't there some responsibility? Obviously, if that's the result of the current market, is that a market failure, or doesn't government need to do something about that? And should it do something other than just give people more benefits?
I guess the question I would pose is, are we arguing that the minimum wage is an effective anti-poverty tool? Because generally speaking, the consensus is that it isn't. Christina Romer, who was head of Barack Obama's economic advisors, in an op-ed that published earlier this year, was explicit about this. She said that it is inefficient and ineffective to really fixing our poverty problem. And so you can talk about minimum wage, but you have to do it in a context that is very clear that it is not fixing poverty and it is not a poverty solution.
Peter Eaton.
Well, we have never tried to use the minimum wage to effectively combat poverty. If we tried to do that, then we would end up with a minimum wage that was, in fact, a living wage. That's never been the objective of the minimum wage as a program. It's so we've never tried that, and to say that you can't use it as an effective program, we have no idea if we can use it as an effective program. There have been studies, for example, a very famous one by Card and Kruger in the Northeast, where there were two neighboring states, one of which had a state minimum wage that they raised and the other of which didn't. And the argument was that the fast food industries in the state with a higher minimum wage would leave or would reduce their employment, and in fact the exact opposite occurred. So there is no real justification for the argument that raising the minimum wage is going to substantially reduce the number of low-wage workers.
We're running low on time. I want to take just one more call from Wesley in Wyandotte County. Wesley, welcome to Central Standard. Wesley, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Quickly.
First time caller, long time listener.
Great. Give us your comments as quickly as you can, Wesley.
I think an important issue that hasn't been brought up here is political power. Since Citizens United, it's always been an issue, but it's really exploded. The more wealth you have, the more political power you can purchase. And also, the less wealth the rest of the country has, the less political power they can have. So if you're a big corporation and you can purchase more political power while also lowering the wages of everyone else, you decrease their political power as well.
All right. Wesley, appreciate the comment. And I think actually we're going to leave it there. We'll have to leave it as a question of political power and of economics and how they intertwine. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Peter Eaton, who's Associate Professor of Economics at UMKC, Patrick Ishmael, Policy Analyst for the Show Me Institute. Thanks to both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the life of a legendary figure in Kansas City education and medicine, Dr. E. Gray Diamond. He died Sunday at the age of 94. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. On Sunday evening, Kansas City lost one of its educational and medical pioneers. E. Gray Diamond died at the age of 94. He transformed the KU Medical School. He was a world-renowned cardiologist. And then, in 1971, at age 55, a founder of the medical school at UMKC. Joining us to remember the life of Igre Diamond are two men who knew him and worked with him. Dr. Felix Sabatez is a professor and founding chair of the Department of Ophthalmology at the UMKC School of Medicine. Dr. Sabatez, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Harry Jonas is former dean of UMKC School of Medicine. Dr. Jonas, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So any person is more than the list of things that they accomplished, but my goodness, Igre Diamond sure accomplished quite a long list of things, Dr. Sabatez.
You are absolutely right. I had the great pleasure of knowing him for 45 years. He was a unique individual. And an individual that you actually learn to love and to respect. Well, he has a tremendous intellect, and basically he was a fighter, which I love to, for these things that he believed.
He started as the chair of medicine at the KU Medical School at the age of 33. It seems awfully young.
Yes, he was the youngest person to ever take that chair. And did a marvelous job as chair.
One of the youngest in the country, I understand. Yeah,
absolutely. I think he was the most young person that ever took that job in the United States.
And to what do you attribute that about him? I mean, what enabled him to show that kind of leadership at such an early age?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, it's a pleasure and a privilege to be here with Dr. Jonas. He has, in itself, is quite a figure in the field of medicine in general. And he was one that implemented a lot of the things that were done at the medical school, very devoted and a good friend. The thing that, I come from a different country. I could not go back to my country origin. So I've been in this country only for 6 years when I first met him. So I was learning every day how this country works. Here has this gentleman who is from Mississippi, who was actually very caring. He was very concerned about minorities as well as female, and he had an idea. He had an idea that he felt that students that want to go to this particular school and that go into medicine directly. Of course, that's a system that exists everywhere else, in my own country, in Europe, and so forth and so on. But in the United States, it was something that was heresy. I mean, something that was not done. And he was so strong in his principles that he went through. He was criticized. And basically, if you look at the whole Hospital Hill area, nothing would have happened there. The quality of care that he brought in by bringing the medical school and by sticking to the principles that he believed very strongly.
Well, I want to ask about that. He was already a well-known cardiologist before he came over to work on the UMKC Medical School, just getting started.
Yes.
Why on earth would he leave his already successful career? He didn't leave the career, but add to it this work in helping start a new medical school and with a different kind of program?
Well, Gray was an intellect. He was highly intelligent, really brilliant. And he was totally dedicated to education. And he loved the job at KU because they had a teaching program. They had students. They had residents. And he loved the opportunity to teach. But he had studied the format of medical education. And if you knew Gray at all, you knew he liked to change and change for the better. And so it was his plan that he developed that became the UMKC School of Medicine, a very different plan.
Talk about the plan.
Well, the plan is most unusual, and it was unusual when it started. His idea was that students could be admitted to medical school right out of high school. And there were a lot of critics of that who said, that's too early. Those students are too immature. And he said, well, many of those students are very mature, sometimes more mature than the ones who've gone to 4 years of college. Mm-hmm. And this was a program that was compressed into 6 calendar years. And when the students graduate, they get both the baccalaureate degree and a medical degree. And most people who criticized the program said, well, that's too short. You can't teach all the requirements that are necessary for both degrees. But first of all, the program was compressed into 6 years, and students went all year round. They didn't go with summers off and so forth. And secondly, they started seeing patients in their first day of school, which was a big advantage over the traditional program like I went through, where I went 4 years to college, and then I started medical school, and I didn't see any patients till I was in my third year of medical school. So it was almost 7 years out of the eight before seeing the first patient.
Dr. Sabat, as I read it in an interview in the Kansas City Star last year, Gray Diamond said that his proudest accomplishment is to look and see that there have been 3,000 successful graduates
absolutely.
Of that medical.
And, you know, another thing that is being in Kansas City, which when I came, which was rather enclosed society in the middle of the state, I mean, in the corner of the state, with a street there called State Line, that Gray called it the Iron Curtain, because there was no relationship back and forth. You know, the main thing that he was an internationalist. He was an internationalist. He had friends all over the world. And then he took upon the idea of the understanding China. So he was ahead of his time. And as I recall, you know, he was always... he was always talking about not of his accomplishment, but what people should have done. And one of his classic speeches is when he had to give a speech to the class that was finishing. He was always say, you as a physician, you know, live, you know, let live, but most important, let live. And he won, and that's a classic. I read it two or three times, I guess, his book. I learned so much of him. As I said, as a newcomer in this country, I learned so much in my past 45 years just chatting with him and talking to him.
We're remembering the life of Dr. E. Gray Diamond. That's Dr. Felix Sabates, who is founding chair of the Department of Ophthalmology at the UMKC School of Medicine. And a former dean of that school, Harry Jonas, is also with us. We'd love to hear if you have a memory of E. Gray Diamond to share. Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. I want to ask a little bit about who he was as a person. We've been hearing sort of his professional accomplishments, but what was Gray Diamond like when he wasn't working? Did that ever happen?
Well, he was a great worker, but he had a unique personality. He challenged people that he talked to. He gave them assignments. When I finished my deanship and had retired, Gray called me one day and he said, how would you like to be my luncheon partner? He had met for many years with the former dean at the University of Kansas who had passed away. And he said, would you like to join me for a periodic luncheon? And I said, yes. And he said, well, there are two conditions that you have to abide by. Number one, we share the cost every other time, and I said, well, that's reasonable. Secondly, you have to bring an agenda, and the agenda would be 10 items that you have handwritten on a piece of paper, and they will be arranged 1 to 10, and I will decide which ones I want to talk about. And I may rearrange the order, and there may be some I don't want to talk about at all, and there may be some that I want to talk about the whole time. That was sort of the way he functioned. He also sent the most provocative and stimulating emails that you can imagine. Oh, so his intellect was his behavior. And he was a challenging person. And he certainly challenged the medical community when he developed this different plan of undergraduate and graduate medical education.
I understand his emails are sort of legendary their depth.
He was funny. He was funny. At the opening of the EI Foundation, I remember, and Harry, Jonas, you were there, he said, you know, the looks of the building, you know, who do you think it looks like? So he went on to say about he didn't know Felix and talking that particular part English language that he talks, he said with, he says, you know, this look like, you know, he described that as the Don Quixote of Sancho Panza. I mean, he was so smart. I still have that, and I look at it, and I say, oh, my goodness, you know. He has that funny side. And another thing, I said, he loved animals, he loved his dogs, he loved flowers. He was a really a classy man, a man out of anything that I have met in this country.
Yeah, again, if you have any memories to share of E. Gray Diamond, give us a call at 235-2888, 816-235-2888. 88. You mentioned already, Dr. Sabatis, the trips to China. He actually took half a dozen or more trips to China.
Yes.
He
led
groups.
Yes.
What was the goal of those trips?
Well, I think that I was invited to the first trip. And, of course, I come from Cuba. I was not wanting anything to do with communism. So the second trip, I did go. And it was fascinating, fascinating. I saw in China things that I didn't know and I knew was going to come. And Gray was always, he was gave orders, and he advised everyone that I was going to go, and I prepared some lectures and so forth. So everything went very smooth. And because when we came back to the airport, he was there waiting for us, and the chancellor of the university is going in that group. But every group that went had a tremendous experience. Mine was exciting. I still love to remember what happened at that time.
And I understand that he also wrote 18 books, some of which grew out of those experiences.
Yes, he did. And actually, his interest in China began before he sponsored the trips with Dr. Sabatis and I. It began when he went to China just 6 months before President Nixon had gone to China. The idea was, I think, from the State Department, it would be a good idea to send some American physicians over there to see the country first. So he went over with a group of six or eight physicians, and they met all the leaders of China, which was very unusual, before the president had arrived to sort of cement some relationship. And then the second trip was a trip where he decided that the Chinese should see our medical students. So we went in a group with some faculty and a fairly sizable group of medical students to China. And it was a fascinating trip because Mao Zedong was still living. And Zhou Enlai, who was the sort of the number two person in China, had just died. And the Chinese people were sort of mourning his death. So we had a wonderful time and we were well received by the Chinese. And when we would go out, for instance, to a department store to do some looking, and we'd walk close to a counter where we saw something we might like to buy, the Chinese who were there would separate so they could see us and see what we were going to buy, and they were very courteous. So we had a wonderful trip, and that started his interest, although his interest had gone back to the original time he got started.
816-235-2888 is the number to call with your memories of Dr. E. Gray Diamond, who died on Sunday at age 94. Kevin in Prairie Village is with us. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Dr. Jonas and Dr. Sabatis. This is Kevin Koch. I'm a graduate of UMKC in 1980 from the med school program.
Uh-huh.
I have great memories of both those physicians who are sitting with you right now. They were wonderful and getting us through med school. A couple memories I have of Dr. Diamond. I remember going to his house when he had a reception for all the med students and the walnuts, and he had an enormous turtle in a tank. And it turned out that he had bought this turtle like 30 years earlier at Woolworths and somehow or other had kept it going for years. I don't know if either of you remember that. The other memory I have of him at one point in time, he went out and bought a huge RV and was tooling around in that or around the U.S. And he was always a Renaissance fellow in terms of striking out in lots of different things. He designed his own house next to the med school called diastole, which actually means the rest period of the heart. Anyway, he was just a fascinating fellow, and I feel incredibly blessed to have been able to go to the med school and have a professional career that's been as satisfying as it has been for me.
Thank you so much for the call, Kevin. Let's take one more call from Christopher Leach, who's actually calling in. Christopher, nice to hear from you.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
You have a memory of Dr. Diamond?
Oh, I met him briefly when I was working on a project at the university, and we were talking about the idea for an exhibit of medical imaging as works of art. And that conversation never went anywhere, but very soon thereafter, I got a call from his curator. It seems that Dr. Diamond had an enormous and really stimulating collection of art that he installed at diastole. especially after it became a center, a sort of conference center. And I recall the conversation with the curator being along the lines of, we don't want something that's just decorative or lovely. We really want something that is as stimulating and provocative a thing as you can make, and something that you think as an artist really achieves your goals. And I thought that was really noble as a collector for someone to trust an artist and an artist's intelligence. And the collection itself is really stunning and great viewing if you ever have the opportunity to visit the Diastole Center.
Christopher, thank you so much for calling in.
You bet.
Bye. Diastole is now a retreat center on the UMKC campus, and right. As the earlier caller said, diastole, the period when the heart is at rest,
right.
Which is a,
right,
is
right,
a pretty
right.
brilliant name for a retreat center. I note that that's one sort of physical legacy that Dr. Diamond leaves. If each of you had to name one thing that you think will be his legacy otherwise to the school or to the community, what would it be? Dr. Jonas?
Gray had enormous interests in other things besides medicine, and his profession as a wonderful cardiologist. He was an artist. He was a reader. He had a very strong interest in all kinds of art, and he became very interested in sculpturing. And he was a very, very accomplished sculptor. And if you visit Diastole, you'll see many, many layers, many shelves full of his wonderful sculpting. Now, his daughter, Lark, is also a wonderful sculptress. So she, I'm sure, was sort of schooled in that style by her dad.
The bronze sculpture in front of the medical school is based on a wood carving he did as a much younger man, I understand. And Dr. Sabatis, what will be his legacy?
The creation of the Eye Foundation of Kansas City and the Eye Department at UNKC is entirely due to him. He found the lines. He envisioned what was happening. He blocked every doubt, and even 3 weeks before he died, he told me about certain people were opposed to it. And more important, they gave a beautiful lamp from the 1800s that until the development disappears, he went ahead and donated that.
I want to thank our guests, Dr. Felix Sabatez and Dr. Harry Jonas of the UMKC School of Medicine, for helping us remember the life of Dr. E. Gray Diamond. Indeed, a life well lived. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can hear our podcast or hear this conversation again. You can get our previous shows at the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Join us tomorrow when we will explore the immigrant experience in rural America. That's on KC Currents. Up to Date is next with a look at our local election results from last night, as well as Rupert Murdoch's news empire. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.